I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. This is the news.
To me, the American people are so great.
Reality sets in. Business is closing. Jobs lost. Money running out. Everybody suffering. And in D.C., paralyzed by politics.
Set the political games aside. Help us.
Destruction and devastation. We're on the ground with the people suffering while swaths of California burn. COVID-19 hits the NFL. Another player positive. Steelers-Titans postponed. Is your NFL Sunday in danger of being canceled? And the virus hits home.
300 one day, then 500 the next day.
A new view on the real estate boom in America's suburbs. Good evening. For tens of thousands of Americans, crisis hit tonight. Debilitating, life-altering crisis. October 1, furlough day for 30,000 workers at United and American Airlines. We'll meet some of them in a moment. For the air carriers, movie and hotel chains, restaurant and entertainment groups, and mom-and-pop stores from town to town across. The reality is stark tonight. After 6 months of hanging on and government relief nowhere in sight, too many businesses can hang on no longer, and they've decided their employees have to go. Furloughs at Marriott, Hilton, Uber, and more. That's on top of the 28,000 we heard about from Disney this week. Last week, the Labor Department reports close to 800,000 Americans lost their jobs. The previous week, even more than that. And since COVID, 60 million people have filed for unemployment insurance. 60 million. That is not just a number. Those are our friends and our neighbors trying to pay the bills in the rolling crisis that is COVID-19. They're the victims. Ask the government for help.
All right, Congress, let's seal the deal. Let's pass a COVID relief package.
Ali Malice is one of 33,000 airline workers being furloughed today.
I love my job.
She found her calling in the air and built a life around it. But 6 years after she boarded her first flight for American, the paychecks just stopped.
Will you wait for a callback, even if it's years?
I guess I'll wait for a callback. I hope it'll be soon.
Of course, there aren't many jobs out there to find. Not now.
My husband and I met as flight instructors in Phoenix.
Laura and Max Woods are now both pilots for different airlines, and their future is uncertain and unnerving.
On September 4th, my husband and I opened the mailbox, and we had both received our furlough letters from our airlines on the same day. So we...
From separate airlines on the same day?
We did, yes.
Did you look at each other and go, what are we going to do?
Yes, it's overwhelming. The pressure of obviously of having a young child at home and having another on the way just adds to that.
Max's job is safe for now. Laura could still be laid off in just a few weeks.
No, that's not okay.
Union leaders fight on.
Save our jobs.
This is only going to continue to spiral down because when you start to unravel the airline industry and that network, it becomes weaker and weaker and weaker.
Some analysts think otherwise.
It's really important for the airlines to become far more efficient when they can start to lay off employees or put people on furlough. That will help bring the cash burn down substantially.
We could give away all of it, and it wouldn't solve the problem. Imagine that. 750,000 workers working for free would not take care of the problems in the airline industry right now.
The challenge is ongoing, but brand new for Ali Malice, who, like tens of thousands of other airline workers, has a simple message for Congress tonight.
Set the political games aside. Help us.
Well, both sides say they want to. The House is on track to vote tonight on what they're calling a stimulus bill, but think about it. It's disaster relief. Victims who did nothing wrong need help. Disaster relief. A live report on whatever Congress is doing coming up before we hit a commercial break. Word today that half of New York City's bars and restaurants may be wiped out permanently in the next 6 months. That's from New York State's chief financial officer. Think of it, 14,000 bars and restaurants just gone. Some of my favorites already are. Crispo was an Italian gem on 14th Street. Daddy-O served great burgers till 4 a.m. No more. A new government report on the city's troubles is out today. Most bars and restaurants here are small businesses with fewer than 20 employees. And more than half of the workers are immigrants, making on average about $34,000 a year. CBC's Frank Holland in Harlem now with a business owner who says he might have to shut down for good. Frank.
Well, Shepard, it's certainly a big concern for business owners like this one that you see behind me. He's very concerned about his ability to stay open and stay in business when many of the people who are his customers may lose their jobs.
Culinary creations are what Chef J.J. Johnson prefers to focus on at his restaurant in Harlem. But in recent days, instead of rice recipes, he's been stewing over reports of rising COVID numbers.
Your favorite restaurant might not come back. If there's a second wave for restaurants, that might mean 100% of restaurants close, 80% of restaurants close.
And layoffs that could impact his core customers.
Especially in Harlem, talking about working class America losing their job, that's who supports us. If they don't have a job, we won't be open. It's just that simple.
Small business owners across the nation under pandemic pressure. According to Yelp, from April to September, permanent business closures, they increased by 165%. Amar Espinoza is a bartender who has seen his income fall sharply because of fewer tips. If his restaurant closes, he'd be out of much more than just a job.
If I don't have a job, I got to go back to Mexico, or I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do if I don't have a job. I'm an immigrant, so I don't really receive any, you know, any support, any help.
Katrina Paris-Penn and her husband own a home and lifestyle store that's been hit hard by the lack of tourism.
Things have been hard, and they're going to get harder. And until we get, you know, COVID under control, we are going to have hard times ahead of us.
And, Chef, it has been especially hard for low-wage workers, the people who would make your food in a restaurant like the one that Chef J.J. opened here. According to the Pew Research Center, nearly half of them have lost their job or had to take a pay cut during the pandemic.
Back Frank Holland, uptown in the big city. Thanks. And while many businesses barely hang on, Americans are like Allie Malice, whom you met a minute ago, the flight attendant, are waiting. They're waiting for elected leaders to find some common ground. It's been 6 months since the government passed the first $2 trillion relief package. The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin spoke again today, they tell us. Still nothing, but a pledge to keep talking at least. Secretary Mnuchin has a $1.6 trillion proposal. The House Speaker a $2.2 trillion proposal. The House debates the Democratic plan today. Republicans in the Senate say it won't even get a look over there. Washington. CNBC's Elon Moyes live in D.C. What's the problem? How far apart are they and on what?
Well, Shep, what I'm hearing is the problem is size and scope. Moderate Democrats have been pushing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to stay at the table and keep talking. And of course, a bill that could pass the Senate and be signed into law is the gold standard. But what we're also hearing from sources in the center is that there have been five straight days of negotiations that have gone nowhere. And they're looking at the layoffs. They're looking at the kids who can't get back to school. And they're looking at the long lines at the food bank. And they're saying that $2.2 trillion is the lowest they can go. Now, Pelosi herself is framing this argument as a difference, not just over dollars, but also of values, and that she's unwilling to take the path of least resistance. On the other hand, Republicans say Democrats won't take yes for an answer. The White House proposal actually covers a lot of the same ground as the Democrats. It just doles out less money.
First, I would say Nancy Pelosi is not being serious. If she becomes serious, then we can have a discussion here. But
we
raised our offer.
Shep, that is the political reality. The practical reality for so many American families is that this means they're probably going to have to wait until after the election for another round of relief.
Oh, man. Do they agree on anything?
Well, that's the irony here, Shep. There actually are lots of places where they do agree. They both want to send direct checks to families. They both want to support small businesses and send aid to the airlines to avoid layoffs. They both want to make sure that kids can get back in school and send those schools more money. The reality, Shep, is that we are in an all or nothing fight. And right now we got nothing.
Elon Moy live in Washington. So is this the start of a second wave of layoffs? For many Americans, the anxiety is real. CNBC's senior economics correspondent Steve Leisman is here. Tens of thousands of job cuts announced this week alone. How much worse does it look like this is going to get without a stimulus bill? Do you know yet from the data?
You can't know precisely, Shep, but we know that really strong and massive government relief packages help keep the economy afloat in the early months of the recession, help lead to a pretty strong recovery. But still, there's 11 million people that don't have a job that had one before the pandemic. That by itself is a pretty bad recession on its own. Many more could be at risk without a relief package. A double-dip recession, some economists say, Shep, is possible.
It's like there are two economies, you know. The layoffs keep coming. And yet the economic numbers inside the data look good. People without a job are not living the same thing they are on Wall Street.
No, there's very different things happening in this economy right now, Shep, things we've never seen before. The best way to think about it is if the entire nation was hit by a hurricane. The high ground, people who have been able to work from home, places that were not affected by COVID, they're coming back fast, and they've come back fastest. The low ground, the frontline workers, the retail jobs, leisure and hospitality jobs, those jobs were wiped out. They may never come back, like a beach house that's been, you know, wiped out from a hurricane, Shep. And so you've had people in the stock market make millions, and some people left absolutely destitute by this pandemic.
But in Washington, we just heard Elon say there may not be disaster relief stimulus bill until after the election. That's more than a month. We're talking about people who, in many cases, millions of them live paycheck to paycheck. What about the rent? What about the food? What about the kids? You know, this is looking dire.
We've had an unusual recession here, Shep, in part because that government stimulus meant that there was not a lot of foreclosures and a lot of missed payments on mortgages. There's also mortgage forbearance. Now that those things are going away, I'll give you an example. Just this morning, the government reported a 2.7% decline in personal income. That's the third largest monthly decline since 1959. Where did that decline come from? The absence or the elimination of government benefits.
Steve Leisman, thank you. So COVID is at the root of all of this, but new today, Amazon reports, listen to this, 19,000 of its U.S. workers have tested positive for COVID in the last 6 months. For context, that's one out of 72 of its frontline workers. Further, more testing is coming, they say. 50,000 U.S. workers to be tested every day by November. Again, this is developing. Deirdre Boza with the late numbers. What's Amazon saying?
Well, Shep, this is the first time since the pandemic took hold that Amazon is coming out with comprehensive data into the rate of infection across its workforce. Now, to put that number, nearly 20,000 workers who have tested positive into context, that is out of about 1.4 million frontline employees across the United States. And Amazon says that is about 40% lower than expected based on the general U.S. rate of infection. But, Shep, we should also note that this disclosure comes months after labor groups, politicians, regulators, and us, the media, have asked for these numbers. The company also providing, as you mentioned, an update on testing. It says that it wants to test 50,000 and expects to test 50,000 workers per day by November. Back over to you.
Deirdre Boza, thanks. Fires are raging right now in California. More than 11,000 square miles of the West Coast burned so far this year. That's a total larger than the state of Massachusetts. It's incredible. Cal Fire reports the Zog Fire, which is up in the north there, killed a fourth person yesterday. And take a look at this destruction. Entire homes up in flames. 150 miles south in the Glass Fire in Wine Country, it's still burning. Cal Fire reporting it's essentially unchecked, just 5% contained. Alameda County Fire Department taking this video, miles of land charred, miles and miles, and firefighters working to make sure everyone is out and safe. Miguel Almaguer is in St. Helena. Miguel, high winds, bad heat. When's the break coming?
Well, Shep, there's a sliver of good news out here. Today it was in the triple digits, but over the next couple of days, we expect the temperatures to drop significantly. But the bad news is this wildfire has done a ton of damage. As we told you yesterday, hundreds of homes are believed to be destroyed. That number could actually be much higher. What you're looking at here is a school that was built in 1902. It's more than 100 years old. And for the first time, a teacher who worked here for several years came back to see the damage herself. Here's what she had to say.
It was a wonderful, friendly school where everybody was so happy and friendly and all united. Makes me sad to see that this is what's happened to it.
The bad news is she's not going to be the last person to see destruction like this. It really does litter Sonoma and Napa County's wine country, the heart of wine country here. More than a dozen vineyards have also been damaged or destroyed. So that's bad news for a multi-billion dollar industry in this area. The fires, for the most part, are still raging out of control. There is some containment. Those numbers are low. And firefighters say they are expecting to get better control of those blazes over the next couple of days as those temperature drops. The bad news, Shep, they believe these fires are going to burn into the winter. Shep, back to you.
Miguel, I'm looking at the weather forecast. 101 on Friday where you are, 98 on Saturday, finally gets into the 80s on Sunday. And for 15 days out, nothing but sunshine. What are they going to do?
Well, those temperatures are awful for firefighters, right? They're walking around with 60, 70 pounds of gear on them, so it really slows them down. It also zaps out the humidity here, so everything is bone dry. Everything is this tinderbox fuel ready to explode. Those are the conditions that firefighters are working against, and there's nothing they can do to combat that. What they're trying to do is bring more men and women off of the backup lines and bring them onto the front lines. There's about 18,000 of them working across the state, but it's not enough because there's so many wildfires burning in California, upwards of 24, some two dozen or so, that they really have been exhausted working these 48, 72-hour shifts straight before they break for a day and then come back for four or five more days of exactly what you're seeing here behind me. They really are up against a rock and a hard space here, and they're doing all they can to stop these fires. So far, they're not having much success. Yes.
Miguel Almaguer in St. Helena, north of San Francisco. Thank you, sir. 33 days now till you vote. If you've got it, you spend it. If not, walk it off.
Get out and vote. We got to win. We got to win.
Ground game versus spending spree.
We can own 21st century.
A tale of two campaign strategies, but which will pay off? COVID fears up, mammogram screenings down. The life-saving information everyone should hear. And later, who can climb a 32-story building? Nailed it. Why, this man is scaling a skyscraper in cowboy boots.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 60 seconds.
Days till the election, and we're following the money. Joe Biden's outspending President Trump in a big way on TV and radio. The Biden campaign spent $153 million on ads across the country last month. That's nearly triple what the Trump campaign spent. And would you look at Pennsylvania, a battleground that candidate Trump won in 2016. The NBC political unit reports the Trump campaign has spent around $4.5 million since Labor Day there. The Biden camp, $20 million. Ali Vitale following the Biden campaign. Ali spending a lot and pounding the pavement. The Biden campaign, tell us.
Spending a lot, pounding the pavement, and raising a lot of money in the process. The Biden campaign confirmed to me today that since that really raucous debate on Tuesday night, they've raised over $30 million. And that's the kind of fundraising haul that has allowed them to be spending as much money as they have been on TV. But while they've been spending on TV, the Trump campaign has been capitalizing on grassroots organizing, specifically pounding the pavement and meeting people at their front doors. This is a tried and true organizing tactic, but one that the Biden campaign, because of the pandemic, largely opted out of. And in the process, they leaned into digital organizing tools. While they were doing that, they sort of argued that pounding the pavement wasn't necessarily as effective as meeting voters where they were online. But today they've reversed course on that, a senior Biden official saying to us that they are putting back in place grassroots organizing, knocking on doors. And that's a little bit of a reversal, but they explain it as saying that that's their way of making sure that all of their bases are covered as voters start tuning in with these 30 some odd days to go before the election.
Ali Vitale on Team Biden. Thanks. Now to the Trump campaign. Hallie Jackson's here, NBC News chief White House correspondent. Hallie, he's been outraised and outspent, but there's another battle, and that's to get voters registered, and it looks like he's on that one.
Yeah, sure. At least from the data that we're seeing so far, Shep, you're right about that. You talked about the battleground state of Pennsylvania, and the numbers there from our political unit show that Republicans have registered something like 135,000 new voters versus Democrats coming in at just about 57,000. There is a difference here, and you're seeing that in several key battleground states. Why is that? Well, it's the thing that you and Allie were just talking about, right? The famed ground game. The idea that President Trump and his campaign have had people out there doing door knocks. The Biden campaign is just now kind of getting on that. Now, I've spoken with officials from both campaigns just tonight, and the Biden team says, listen, we have been having meaningful conversations in other ways, virtual ways, ways that people feel more comfortable with during a pandemic. The Trump campaign, though, feels like the things that they've been doing have been paying off. Like, for example, those rallies, Shep, they say that there may be this sort of shy Trump voter that they're seeing again this year in 2020, just like they did in 2016. Statistics provided to me by a Trump campaign official show that about 15 to 20%, they say, of people who show up at these rallies hadn't voted in 2016. So they're trying to get those people registered to vote. They're trying to get the turnout up because obviously that's the way that you win an election.
And the Trump campaign is still talking about the debate. I saw the president tweet about it today.
He's been tweeting about it today. He's been tweeting about it yesterday, Shep. He's definitely thinking about it. It's on his mind. He believes that he did a good job, right? We know that because he says that he thinks he did a good job. And publicly, that is what you're hearing from his campaign and folks close to him as well. But, Shep, as you know, there is often a dichotomy between the public and the private stuff that you hear from campaigns. And privately, people that I've talked to close to the campaign are a little concerned, right? Their best hope is that that debate performance in which President Trump was particularly aggressive did not turn off any voters. They've sort of, it seems, given up the hope that he would have won any voters over, although campaign aides publicly will say they think he did. So at this point, there is a lot of uneasiness about some of that. There's a lot of eyeballs on the next debate coming up, too. But you've even seen some of the president's Republican colleagues over on Capitol Hill on the Senate side, for example, talk about how they wish he had been a little more forceful and more clear in his condemnation, for example, of that white supremacist group, the Proud Boys.
You know, yesterday, the debate committee told us that they were thinking about making a format change for this next debate. Anything more on that?
Yeah, sources say that there may be a discussion of, for example, cutting off the candidates' microphones. I can tell you both campaigns say they're ready to show up. And interestingly, people that I talked to from both campaigns say they think the next debate, it's a town hall format, remember, so it's not going to be like what we saw this week. They think that actually serves both of their candidates well, a chance to sort of be more one-on-one with voters.
Hallie Jackson, live in Washington. Hallie, thank you. Ideology steers a lot of us in politics, right? But are we a more tribal nation? We're measuring the money tonight at CNBC, the ads, the doors knocked, but it won't matter if everybody's minds are already made up, right? If everybody's on a team, like I'm for Ole Miss and whoever's playing LSU, no matter what the day is, that does not change. Has politics changed, become like that? There's actual data on it. Steve Kornacki's here with that. Steve, what are you seeing?
Yeah, Shep, this has been a presidency and a campaign like no other from this standpoint. What you see here, this is the average daily approval rating for Donald Trump, his entire presidency. What I want to show you here is look how tight the range is. His highest approval rating was 47%. It was this year just as COVID was taking hold. His lowest was 37. That's a range of just 10 points between high and low. And where is he right now? By the way, he's about 45.5%. But this range of just 10 points from high to low, we have never seen a presidency like this. Put this in comparison. These are all of Trump's modern predecessors. Look, their approval ratings all got at least 20, 25 points higher than his at some point in those ranges from high to low for past presidencies, the 60s, the 40s, the 30s. Trump's is just 10. People have had their mind made up for or against him. And no matter what's been happening, it just has barely been budging. And the same is true in the presidential race. Look, the biggest margin Joe Biden's had on average, he's been ahead by just over 10 points at its height. His smallest lead has been 4. Trump has never been closer than that. This race has been between 10 and 4.5 points the entire way. Right now, it's at about 7. This presidential race has been operating within a 6-point range. Trump's approval within a 10-point range for 3.5 years. People's minds have been made up by and large.
Except for the undecideds. I hear they exist. I've never really seen them. What's moving them?
Yeah, we're talking about it looks like from the CNBC change poll, maybe about 6 or 7% of the electorate. It's small, but it could be critical. Let's look at that group, the folks who say they could change their mind. Again, about 6 or 7%. What do they think of these two candidates from the CNBC change poll? Well, they don't like Biden that much. A 36 favorable, 49 unfavorable. But here's the thing. They don't like Trump even more, 27 favorable, 59 unfavorable. The folks who say they could change their mind, the swing voters, they don't like either candidate, but they're a little less hostile. Maybe that's the way to say it, to Biden than they are to Trump.
A lot of time to go. Steve Kornacki, thanks a lot. Did you know COVID-19 is hitting working women harder than men? A lot harder, the new data shows, and it's making the gender gap even worse. We have the details in a new report coming, and cases are spiking across our country. Scientists say a second wave is coming, but in Europe, it's already arrived. We're live in Paris, where the doctors say what's happening in France may be our guide for what's coming to America. Protesters demand justice for the victim of a police shooting. And a little boy spreading love to firefighters with a Yoda doll on a CNBC trip, coast to coast. Portland, a new face for the protests against racial injustice. Last night, demonstrators marched in the name of Patrick Kemmons. Police there shot and killed him 2 years ago. A grand jury ruled the officer's actions were justified, but protesters say they want the investigation into his death reopened. San Diego. The city's soccer club took a knee and walked off the field mid-match, forfeiting the game yesterday. Team members say an opposing player called an openly gay teammate a homophobic slur.
They were very clear in that moment that they were giving up all hopes of making the playoffs, even though they're beating one of the best teams in the league, handedly. But they said it doesn't matter.
New York. Two teenagers among the first group of girls to become Eagle Scouts. Only 6 out of 100 earned that rank, and now the girls are the elite of the elite. Boy Scouts have been around for more than a century, but they only started letting females join last year. Oregon and California. The force is with the firefighters. A 5-year-old boy donating a baby Yoda to Oregon firefighters. He sent a note, "Here is a friend for you in case you get lonely." Now, Baby Yoda has helped put out fires all across the West Coast. And today's Coast to Coast, that wraps. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour, time for the top of the news. COVID-19 and the dreaded second wave, Dr. Fauci and other scientists say it is coming, but in Europe it is now. Take a look, all combined, all the daily new cases in Europe from March till today. This is Johns Hopkins data. There's that second wave. Spain, Poland, the UK all spiking. France now, it's averaging 12,000 new cases a day, much higher than the first peak back in March. It sounds bad, but there is some good news. That red line you see, that red line is the number of deaths. That's low compared to the spring. And that's why so many Europeans are saying enough's enough with the lockdowns. Let us out. Matt Bradley live in Paris tonight. Matt, who's telling you they want the restrictions eased now?
Well, Shep, it's business people, it's politicians, even some doctors. And they're saying that, you know, that these new restrictions are going to add even more damage to this already damaged economy. And I mean, look, here on the world famous Champs-Élysées, it's around 1 a.m. This street should be packed with people. But instead, here, just like in London, bars and restaurants have to close around 10 p.m. That's ever since Monday. That's causing a lot of anger.
In southern France, restaurant owners are in the streets. "I'm going to stay open," she says. "I have the keys to my business. It's mine. I paid for it." Furious over fresh COVID regulations shutting down all bars and restaurants in France's south and making people wear masks outdoors in major cities. Most doctors say the caution is necessary, that the rise in new cases will lead to more deaths.
"This is the beginning of the second wave. And we all hope that the second wave will not be as high as was the first wave."
But with deaths and hospitalizations so low, France's so-called second wave looks more like a ripple than a tsunami. That has some doctors wondering if the so-called second wave exists at all. I asked this doctor, are we in the second wave?
No, pas du tout.
No, not at all, he said. The notion of a second wave would be like a reappearance or a resurgence of a large number of cases. We're not seeing anything like this.
Or, pour l'instant, nous ne voyons rien de ça.
You know, Shep, most doctors here say that the second wave is real and that deaths and hospitalizations are going to start to tick up in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, the French government has vowed to live with the virus. And they say that no matter what, even if they do impose these restrictions, you know, the problem here is it's unclear if the French public would actually abide by that.
Yeah, and they're getting all kinds of mixed messages. That's obvious. They're aware, right, that deaths are a lagging indicator. First the cases go up and then later people start dying.
Yeah, but they're aware of that, of course. But then, you know, in the next couple of weeks, we've already started to see that. We've already started to see those cases go up probably 4 weeks ago. We started to see now the number of people in hospital, the number of people who are in those intensive care centers, that started to go up just a little bit. And we're starting to see really worrying signs from the government. There was a press conference tonight by the Minister of Health. He was saying that the signs are really bad and they're really thinking about reimposing a more thorough, more full lockdown here in Paris. But we're going to hear that decision on Monday. Shep?
Matt Bradley, live in Paris. Are you missing your doctor visits because of COVID? A lot of us are. The data shows we're postponing yearly checkups and cancer screenings. The doc says that's dangerous. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. It now represents 1 in 4 cancers in women. 1 in 4. And the fear is that could worsen if you don't catch it early. CNBC's Contessa Brewer on the impact of skipping screenings.
She called and said, you know, I'm really sorry, but it is cancer.
In June, with the pandemic raging, Debbie Zeman was about to lose her job and her health insurance. She scheduled a mammogram before that happened.
Luckily, I caught it early because I went in.
But two-thirds of Americans report they delayed or canceled their cancer screenings because of the COVID crisis, which could mean 10,000 additional breast and colorectal deaths over the next decade.
The earlier we catch these things, the better we can make sure that we treat them.
She did so good.
Dr. Tara Shirazian is an OBGYN at NYU Langone, but teaches women's health around the world. She worries about her patients skipping screenings, especially in underserved neighborhoods.
A lot of the Black communities, Hispanic communities, seek care at lower rates. And so I am concerned that in these groups of women and others like them, that they may not be coming in for routine screening.
Have you been around anyone that's been exposed to coronavirus?
To prevent COVID infections, the healthcare centers have strict rules: masks, mobile check-in, spaced out appointments. But that won't matter if patients don't go.
I think it's the biggest mistake any woman could make, not to go in. It could have saved my life. It probably did save my life.
Look, one of the other big obstacles to cancer screenings in the age of COVID, millions of people have lost their jobs and their health coverage has gone along with it, Shep.
Yeah, so much. How's Deb doing, by the way?
She's fighting. She's undergoing radiology treatments. And she told me because she needs the insurance, she's paying through the nose for private insurance at this point. Doesn't have it through her employer any longer.
Contessa Brewer, live tonight. Thanks. COVID isn't hurting just women's health, also their careers. A new report suggests 1 in 4 women is considering quitting her job or scaling back on responsibilities. Many women just too busy in the COVID world. The report surveyed 40,000 workers and comes from the nonprofit firm McKinsey. The people most affected? Moms, senior level, and Black women. The report warns of a possible female flight from the workforce, rolling back years of hard-won gains in gender equity. There are some bright spots, though. The shift to remote work opening up all kinds of new opportunities for those who can't relocate or manage a long commute. No house too small and no price too high. Pandemic fears sending people packing for the suburbs. And Crocs are still a thing. You better believe it. That's On the Money, next from CNBC.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 90 seconds.
Stocks ending the day higher, tech companies in particular leading the way yet again, and that's what's on the money from CNBC tonight. The heads of Facebook, Google, and Twitter are on the hot seat. A Senate committee has sent subpoenas to the CEOs of all three. It'll focus on how they decide what content to leave up and what gets taken down. PepsiCo says snacks are hot in a pandemic. That meant it also higher sales of Cheetos and Doritos and Tostitos and everything delicious. And for macaroni and cheese products, too, demand has skyrocketed. Overall, sales are up 5%. And Justin Bieber may be wearing more rubber shoes. The singer posted an orange pair of Crocs on Instagram with the word soon. That alone sent Croc shares up 10%. Good grief. On Wall Street, the Dow up 35 today, the S&P up 0.5%. NASDAQ, look at that, up almost 1.5%. If you're trying to buy a new house, you better act quick, and you better be willing to pay up. According to a new report from Realtor.com, there are now 40% fewer homes on the market than this time last year. They're also being scooped up 12 days faster than last year, and prices up 10%. There's a lot in there. Our Diana Olick with the great migration back to the suburbs.
This was the scene from a front door camera at a newly listed home in Long Island, New York.
We knew that we would be getting offers for it, but it was nothing like the amount and the volume of interest that came in.
Edgardo Bacalan and his wife put their house on the market in August and immediately got requests for showings.
300 one day, then 500 the next day.
They got so much interest that they decided to screen potential buyers for financials first and then line them up around the block.
For 6 days, we showed the house and we got 53 scheduled viewings. From those 53 viewings were 23 offers. A lot of the offers came from areas like Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens, which is not, I guess, typical.
Not so typical before the pandemic, but a growing trend now as urban apartment dwellers seek more space both inside and out. Suburban homes are in high demand, and getting one often means a bidding war.
Vanessa Cruz lived in a 650-square-foot apartment in Queens, New York for close to two decades, relishing the urban lifestyle until COVID hit home.
Being stuck in such a small space, especially not being able to get fresh air, not having any outdoor space that was safe to sit in, was really weighing on my mind.
Cruz had COVID herself, recovered, and decided it was time to get out.
God forbid I should get sick again. I have space to move around, and I'm not trapped in two rooms.
So she returned to New Jersey, where she grew up, made an offer on a home at the end of May, but lost out to other bids. She won the next home and promptly made the move, which was smart because by the end of July, home sales in New Jersey were up close to 40% annually, and the supply of homes for sale was down about the same. Because like her, more people are now willing to pay a premium for peace of mind.
There is, of course, a limit to how much people can pay. Home prices are going up and much faster than wages in most places. If there's any increase in mortgage rates, that'll also bump some buyers out of the running. And while supply is down in every price range, the worst crunch is at the low end of the market, which, as we all know, Shep, is where those critical first-time buyers live.
No doubt. Diana Olick, thanks so much. A slice of controversy and poisonous accusations as we go round the world. In 80 seconds. Russia, a spokesperson for Vladimir Putin, accusing the opposition leader Alexei Navalny of working with U.S. intelligence officials. Remember, back in August, somebody poisoned him, and the analysts say they believe Putin was behind it. Navalny flown to a German hospital after falling ill. The Putin rival posting this picture after spending weeks in intensive care. United Kingdom. It's Black History Month there, and to celebrate, the Postal Service is painting their traditionally red mailboxes black and gold and putting on them images of black British icons. At the end of the month, they'll go back to red, so now's the time to start snapping those photos. Ireland. Going against the grain. Get this. The Supreme Court ruling Subway's sandwich bread is not bread at all. The judge is concluding these rolls contain too much sugar to be legally considered bread there. The fast food chain will be losing some dough, too, since Ireland gives tax breaks for serving staple food items. Germany. Check out your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man in action. He's dressed in a silver suit and cowboy boots. The famed climber Alain Robert scaling this 32-story skyscraper in Frankfurt. The French Spider-Man now facing a criminal investigation and a fine. And he's putting Peter Parker to shame on this trip around the world in 80 seconds. 2020 voting is happening now. People making their voices heard however they can. Look at this woman in Chicago wearing a hazmat suit. She's 102 years young. B. Lumpkin, the name. Casting her vote by mail-in ballot. The teachers' union says she was a member of that, tweeting, "If B can do it, anybody can do it. Vote." Meantime, one county in Florida is sending out more than 500,000 ballots a day. We're live on the ground right there with an eye on the process. The vote now on the Republican governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, ordering ballot drop-off locations to shut down. He is limiting the places people can go to one designated site per county. Governor Abbott making the announcement today. It goes into effect tomorrow. Texas, just one of the states that has already begun mail-in voting. And a map we're about to show you indicates some form of voting is already happening. All the areas in yellow or yellow stripes. In full yellow, early voting is kicked off. In blue, states that have started to send in mail-in ballots. And then there's Miami-Dade County, which has sent out more than 500,000 ballots. They did so today down south. That's a huge uptick from 2016 when they received a little more than 400,000 vote-by-mail requests. Kerry Sanders in Miami-Dade today checking in on the process. Kerry, more than 500,000 ballots in one day. How are they handling that?
Well, they've handed them over now, Shep, the 500,000 to the Postal Service. They're already in the Postal Service system. They could begin showing up in boxes for voters in Miami-Dade as early as tomorrow. Those 500,000 votes join 5 million ballots that are already in the postal stream in Florida. In fact, many of them have already arrived at voters' homes. In some cases, they've been filled out and sent back. In fact, 4.7% of all the mailed out votes have already been returned. Now, as they return, they will eventually on October 12th be opened and they will actually be run through the system. That's to prevent a backlog on election night. They'll have them all counted. Of course, Shep, it remains a secret, so nobody knows who's winning and who's losing in the race. But getting that backlog out of the way means that in all likelihood, we will have vote totals completed in the state of Florida probably at around midnight on election night, Shep.
Not bad. Kerry Sanders in South Florida, and all those ballots have to be returned, and they have to be returned on time. NBC stations across the country and CNBC are putting the post office to the test. Here's CNBC's Kayla Tauchi.
Mail-in voting, it's going to be the greatest fraud in the history of elections.
Zero evidence that that's true.
As the messaging battle continues, the messengers are still at work, with more than half of states having sent out absentee ballots for the November election. Last month, 12 NBC-owned stations and NBC Elects continued an experiment, sending 426 first-class letters between a dozen cities to test the speed of the mail. The performance in September mirrored August, 88% of the letters arriving within 3 business days, the Postal Service's on-time benchmark. The rest of the letters got delivered later, but 2 of the letters still had not arrived after 2 weeks. Experts say mail arriving late is better than not at all.
The stakes could be extraordinarily high in very narrow elections, but it's all going to depend upon how many ballots actually get sent through the mail this time around.
In North Carolina, officials say demand for mail-in voting is unprecedented.
Traditionally, North Carolinians only about 4 to 5% vote absentee by mail. And, you know, we're tracking right now to have 30 to 40% participate by mail. So it really becomes a logistics operation.
After President Trump suggested the Tar Heel State's absentee voters cast an illegal backup ballot in person.
Let them send it in and let them go vote. And if their system's as good as they say it is, then obviously they won't be able to vote.
The state is putting its own checks and balances in place.
We implemented intelligent mail barcode in order to do the tracking service, but that also helps things to be more expedient for the Postal Service.
North Carolina's Board of Elections has received 300,000 completed ballots already, a record with 33 days still to go. The USPS is convinced the volume is no match for its operation. A spokesperson says even if everyone in America mails his or her ballot, that's still less mail than the Postal Service handles on a given day. For the news, I'm Kayla Tausche in Washington.
Serious trouble in the NFL. As the NFL goes, so goes the nation, right? 11 Tennessee Titans now, 11 of them testing positive for COVID. And now there's a decision on whether they'll even play the Steelers this weekend. Those are germ-killing robots. Kid you not, two of them are now on scene in another NFL city. Can they be the difference maker? Nice work, Yankees. That was quick. Ball game over. Series over. The Yankees sweep. The Yankees sweep. Goodbye, Indians. Took till the wee hours of the morning to do it. 10 minutes shy of 5 hours, but it's in the books. Longest nine-inning game in Major League history. Sleeping begins now in Cleveland. It's Yanks-Rays Monday in San Diego. The COVID outbreak's getting worse for the NFL. The Titans are reporting more positive cases in Tennessee, bringing the total number to 11 now. The game against the Steelers now moved to sometime later in the season. Meantime, the Panthers from Carolina are using two virus-killing robots in their facility. NBC's Mike Tirico here. There's a lot on the line. What robots? What are they doing?
Figure out anything, Shep. I mean, at some point, you're going to want to see fans back in the stands. So they've figured out a way somehow to try to make it as disinfected as possible. I've flown to Delta several times, and that's kind of what they're telling folks they're doing. They're spraying down the plane. So if it's making people comfortable, it'd be a way to get them in the stadium. And they're going to have to come back at some point for the economics of all this.
Yeah, sometime. Notre Dame college football, their team's been hit with an outbreak. A lot of people are having to quarantine just because they've been around people. What have we learned in a month of college football during a pandemic?
You know what, college and pro, Shep, what we learned is that this is not going to be a normal season, and it may not be a complete season. Just because your team has a schedule doesn't mean they're going to play every game. There's no guarantee every NFL team is going to play 16 games or the colleges are going to play 11. There's going to be adjustments to the schedule. University of Houston has had five different opening games canceled already. Syracuse was in the tunnel before they were going to play Georgia Tech on Saturday, and there were three uncertainties with tests, so they had to rapidly retest the guys and delay the game a half hour. That's just the way it's going to be in sports. I'm amazed we've gotten this far and seen this many games, but there'll be these issues as we go along the next couple of months.
You know, you wonder if the Big Ten will even ever get going.
It'll be what happens the next 3 weeks, and the Big Ten schedule will get going October 24th, the Pac-12 after that. One thing they haven't done is leave a lot of room. So if there are games that are postponed, there's not going to be a lot of space to get them in before they set the college football playoffs. So that's something we're going to watch here over the next few weeks.
For NFL, is all of the revenue coming from TV? I mean, with no ticket sales, what do you do?
Most all of it. I mean, I did a game on Sunday night on NBC with Chris Collinsworth in the Superdome. There were 750 people, family and friends, no concessions, no drinks sold at a game in New Orleans. Go figure, right? So it's different, and that's going to be a part of this equation. I'll tell you, Shep, the basketball and the hockey folks who just finished their seasons in bubbles, they're trying to figure out how they're going to get fans in whenever they start next season. Yeah. So there's bits and pieces, but not enough to make a difference.
Do the football players, you've talked to them, do they care one way or the other?
They do. I mean, they're serious about it, whether it's masks or the PPE.
No,
or
I mean, do they care if nobody's in the stands?
Oh,
I mean,
fans,
they just play.
You know what they do? Every one of them said, we got to bring our own juice. We got to bring our own energy. It's easier to go on the road and play. Like Aaron Rodgers said, it was so much easier to go play in New Orleans. But they miss the fans being there. Yeah. They really do notice it when they get ready for the game.
Yeah, LSU could have used some fans or something last weekend.
Well, you want to talk Ole Miss football defense or maybe later?
We'll not talk defense. Let's just watch the offense and move along, Tirico. Thank you.
Howdy, Toddy.
Everybody.
Good to be teammates, man.
All right. Mike Tirico, thank you. About 30 seconds to prime time, and here's what's topping the news from CNBC. Amazon reports nearly 20,000 of its frontline workers have tested positive for coronavirus since March. 20,000 of them. Think of it this way. For context, that's one out of every 72 workers on the front line at Amazon. They kept us going during the lockdown, Amazon workers. And now a lot of them are sick. So what's Amazon doing? They're going to be testing a lot more. 50,000 a week starting next week. House Democrats are on track to vote on a coronavirus bill tonight. But Republicans control the Senate, and they've already said it is too expensive. Whether it'll even get to the Senate now is a matter up for discussion. And whether there will be stimulus, read disaster relief, remains unknown. And firefighters bracing for more record high heat and wind as wildfires continue to spread and roast part of California's wine country. And now, you know the news. For this Thursday, October the 1st, 2020, I'm Shepard Smith. Thanks for having us in. Shark Tank is next on CNBC. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.